The believer, it is not so difficult to encounter God. Trouble is, we don't take the time and the wisdom to do it. Everybody wants to meet God. Well, this series is on encountering God and then on encountering Christ in the scriptures, in the church, in the sacraments, and in the poor. Hello, I'm Father Benedict Rochel of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal in the South Bronx in New York. And this is the fifth segment in our series, How Christian is My Prayer? And we've been looking in these last two programs about the question, who is the real Jesus? This is not really our main subject, but it is one that is very important to take up because so many people are confused about who is the real Jesus at the present time. And I told you, you've got to put on your thinking caps for these few programs. We spoke about the influence of rationalism, the idea, very, very popular from the 17th century on, that the human mind can understand everything. Human mind can understand many things, but it doesn't understand everything. It doesn't understand everything physical. Watch. That's gravity. Nobody knows how it works. Are there iron chains here that pull this book down? Nobody knows why this book went down except instead of up or sideways or just didn't hang there. We call it gravity. And the scientific world can predict with great accuracy its power and pull and effects. But nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows what time is or space. Nobody knows what matter is or life. These are electricity or light. Nobody quite knows what light is. So we live surrounded by mysteries. And it's only rather narrow-minded people who think they have them all solved. These physical mysteries are surpassed even by the mysteries of God. It would be a very, very sad and sorry Messiah, Son of the Living God, who you could understand. It wouldn't be the Son of God. And as we pointed out in our last program, the great councils of bishops in the early church defined some key ideas as basic teachings of the church, foundational teachings, so we'd have something to go on, but they don't explain everything. They defined that Jesus Christ is a divine person with a true human nature and a true divine nature joined together in the single person of Jesus, who is God. Now, one of the first issues we have to come to is what the scripture scholars are trying to do. Now, I want to present this in the best possible light that I can. Scripture scholarship in the United States and in England, several other countries, is largely bound up in a rationalistic way of looking at things, which means that you are minimalistic. You take something to mean the least of what it means, which is stupid in religion. Because when you use the word God, it means something quite beyond anything you can think. That if you can't explain it, you shouldn't pay any attention to it. It's called reductionism or minimalism. And there is a general skepticism that it all isn't true anyway. Why these people study the Bible is a mystery to me. But into this battle come people who are believers, solid scholars who believe in the truth of divine revelation. Catholic scholars were not even permitted into this field until the 1940s, when Pope Pius XII allowed them to get into the field to fight it out. But you've got to fight it out according to the rules of the game. And the rules of the game are a little bit hard to understand. The rules of the game are that you cannot make any assumptions of divine power unless you can absolutely prove it. Well, you can't absolutely prove any of it. So people get very selective on what they think they can approve. One very, very competent and hardworking scripture scholar, Father John Meyer, in a book of his on Jesus called The Marginal Jew, says that this is what he's trying to do, and I think it's a very good explanation of what the scholars are trying to do. To explain to my academic colleagues what I propose to do in this book, I use the fantasy of an unpapal conclave. The conclave is when they meet to elect the Pope. Suppose a Catholic, a Protestant, a Jew, and an agnostic, all honest historians cognizant of first century religious movements, were locked up in the Harvard Divinity School library, put on a Spartan diet, and not allowed to emerge until they had hammered out a consensus document on who Jesus of Nazareth was, what he intended in his own time and place. And it's essential that they be based on purely historical sources and arguments, purely. So we don't bring in faith. Well, I have a lot of questions about that. What's an agnostic? I'm a political agnostic. I don't know anything about politics, I mean, about the crowd that's running them now. I'm a political agnostic. What's a Jew? I know Hasidic Jews, Orthodox Jews, Reconstructionist Jews, liberal Jews, conservative Jews, non-religious Jews, atheistic Jews. What's a Protestant? I know High Church Episcopalians, I know Unitarians, and I know everybody in between. I know some that are absolute skeptics. I used to be able to answer the question, what's a Catholic? But I can't even answer that for you right now. Because there are people around who deny what I take to be some of the essential requirements of Catholicism. And they still call themselves Catholics. And they often work at Catholic institutions. So it's very hard to know. What's a Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and agnostic scholar? I don't know. I don't know what the dimensions of their presentations are. I don't know what their prejudgments are. I don't know where they're coming from. Well, Father Meyer is a very, very competent scholar, very cautious, very careful. But he's arguing with them within this purview. And of course, there's something that they're going to have big problems with, and that is miracles. Because there's no rationalist way to deal with a miracle. A miracle is something that is an act of God beyond human reason. You want to deal with it from a reasonable point of view, you usually have to figure out how it didn't happen. And many of you have been treated to rationalist explanations of the miracles of Christ. You remember my friend Mrs. Nussbaum, who said to the man who had the rationalist explanation of Moses taking the children of Israel through the Red Sea and the sea was cut in half. No, it was just low tide. And she said, you were there. I want to take a little look at the rationalists today, because I think it is an intellectually indefensible position. We are surrounded by too many mysteries, even mysteries that are part of science. People will accept mysteries in science, but they won't accept mysteries in divine revelation. So I want to take a look at the miracles of Jesus. But before I do that, I want to take a little look at the people who decide that these miracles did not occur. And I've mentioned to you already the Jesus Seminar. This is a group of people who will deny anything supernatural in the Bible for the most part. Most of them do. I'm using a book here called The Real Jesus, The Misguided Quest for the Historical Jesus and the Truth of the Traditional Gospels. This book, written by Luke Timothy Johnson, who's a distinguished professor at Chandler Theological Seminary at Emory University in Atlanta, this book really takes the Jesus Seminar apart. The first thing that Dr. Johnson does is he gives us some quotations from the person who runs the Jesus Seminar, Dr. Funk, Robert Funk. Here's a few little quotations from the public press. Jesus' only real friends are religious, economic, and moral outcasts of society. And he is accidentally crucified along with other rabble-rousers. That was said in the Washington Post in the 12th of November, 1988. Jesus was a social gadfly, upsetting now this, now that convention. Clearly no conserver of traditional values, no goody-two-shoes. He was something of a party animal. Dr. Funk said that in the Los Angeles Times. And probably the worst is... He says, Jesus is a sort of flower child with an idealistic view of life that is virtually impossible to achieve. More than half the members of the seminar believed that Jesus was probably not celibate, that he did not advocate celibacy as a lifestyle, and that he had a special relationship with at least one woman, but it may not have been a sexual relationship. That's Mary Magdalene. Excuse me. I think they should get lost. What in the world are they doing tinkering with your faith and mine? I must say that I would not join a discussion of who Jesus was with an agnostic. I would not join this discussion with a Jewish person because they couldn't be Jewish, at least in the religious sense of the word, and believe that Jesus is the Messiah. There are Jewish people who have become Christians, who are still ethnically Jews, who and religiously Jewish in their own sense, but the other Jewish people don't admit that they're Jews because they should be looking for the Messiah. There are Jewish people who are Christians who have found him, according to their belief. If you're a Protestant or a Catholic or an Orthodox, you should believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And your discussion should begin there. Now, what about devout Christian scripture scholars? They may have to argue with these people on their own terms, and that is what they are doing. But you can't build your faith, and I can't build my faith on that, or you're going to come up with a lot of rationalism. For instance, you may have heard that when Jesus walked on the Sea of Galilee, he walked on a sandbar. Difficult thing to do since the Sea of Galilee hardly has any sand. It's a rocky lake, and lakes don't have sandbars. There's no tides. Or that when Jesus was transfigured, his whole body gleamed like the sun, that there was a snowdrift on Mount Tabor and the snow glinting off the sun, thought made the apostle think that Jesus was transfigured. You know what I say to that? Get a snow shovel. Get lost. Say it didn't happen at all. But to come up with snowdrifts and sandbars and things like this is most annoying. Let me take up miracles for just a minute. The New Testament is filled with accounts of miracles worked by Jesus. Can I read you one? And I'm particularly not choosing a miracle that has to do with healing. There are many, many miracles of healing. But here's in the Gospel of St. Mark in the 6th chapter. When it grew late, his disciples came and said to him, "This is a lonely place, the hour is late. Send them away to go into the country and villages round and buy themselves something to eat." And he answered, "You give them something to eat." And they said, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And they found out 5 and 2 fish. He commanded them all to sit down by companies on the green grass. And they sat in groups by hundreds and fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed, broke the loaves, gave it to the disciples to set before the people. He divided the 2 fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces of the fish and the bread. And those who had eaten the loaves were 5,000 men. Now, come on. Don't just tell me it was a nice story. It either happened or it didn't happen. And if you say it didn't happen, what are you going to do with the people who were there who said it did happen? I was speaking to one of the most distinguished scripture scholars in the world recently. And he said to me, "There is no doubt that those who wrote these things either were there and thought they happened, or the sources they relied upon were people who were there and thought this happened. That was a miracle. And this is something I never want you to forget. Miracles happen now. Miracles happen in this age. And anybody who tells you that they don't have, that they don't happen now, is obscurantist and dishonest. This is a book called The Voyage to Lourdes by Alexis Carrel, with the introduction by Father Stanley Yockey, a distinguished scientist and writer. Alexis Carrel, in 1912, received the Nobel Prize for his work on blood vessels. For many years, he was the director of the Rockefeller Institute in New York City, now the Rockefeller University, the most distinguished, or one of the most distinguished and prestigious scientific universities in the world. And he was the director there for many years. In 1902, Alexis Carrel, who was then an unbeliever, went to Lourdes as a physician on a train with those seeking a miraculous cure. On that trip was a woman named Marie Valli, age 23, from Lyon. She was dying. She had had tubercular peritonitis for 9 months, tuberculosis in the abdomen, and she had had pulmonary tuberculosis for several years. Her parents had died of tuberculosis. And she was examined. She was on the point of death. Alexis Carrel went along on that trip, and he watched what happened. This book can be purchased now. It is called, published by Real View Books, which is a subsidiary of the American Council on Economics and Society. You can order it. It's very easy to order. It's an inexpensive book. If you don't believe in miracles, buy this book. Carrel, writing about it later on, uses himself in the third person. He just speaks himself as another person, who he calls Lerac, which is Carrel spelled backwards. And he speaks of Marie Valli. He changes her name to Marie Ferrand, because this was going to be published. But he wrote it under his own name, and in the front of the book are the direct clinical observations with the moments that he made, on the exact moment in which they occurred, May 28, 1902. Can I read you a little bit of this? Marie Valli had been had taken to the waters of Lourdes. She was too ill to put into the waters. They had put some of the holy water on her abdomen. Lerac, or Carrel, was very, very skeptical, as was another man with him named Dr. M. They had brought her back, and Carrel writes, "In front of the iron grill, a stretcher was lying. Beside it, Marie Lerac recognized Madame Doe. They made their way toward the grotto to have a closer look. They looked at Marie's stretcher, leaned against the lower wall. She was motionless, her breathing still rapid and shallow. She seemed on the point of death." And he watched. Then he glanced at Marie for again. Suddenly he started. It seemed to him there had been a change. The harsh shadows on her face had disappeared. Her skin was somewhat less ashen. He thought to himself, it's a hallucination. But that was interesting psychologically, because he had never had one before. But if the change in Marie was a hallucination, it was the first one he had ever had. He turned to M. "Look at our patient again. Does it seem to you she's rallied?" "She looks the same to me," M said. "All I can see is she's no worse." Leaning over the stretcher, Lerac took her pulse again and listened to her breathing. "It's less rapid." M said, "She's about to die." Lerac made no reply. To him it was obvious that there was a sudden improvement of her general condition. Something was taking place. He stiffened to resist a tremor of emotion. Standing against the low wall near the stretcher, he concentrated all of his powers of observation on Marie. He did not lift his eyes from her face. Her eyes, so dim before, were now wide with ecstasy as she turned them toward the grotto. It was an undeniable change. Suddenly, Lorac felt himself turning pale. The blanket which covered Marie's distended abdomen was gradually flattening out. "Look at her abdomen," he exclaimed to M. "Yes, it seems to have gone down. It's the folds in the blanket that give that impression." The bell of the basilica struck three. A few minutes later, there was no sign of any distension or swelling in Marie Ferrand's abdomen. He felt like he was going mad. Standing beside Marie, he watched the intake of her breath, the pulsing of her throat with fascination. The heartbeat, though still rapid, had become regular. Something was taking place. "How do you feel?" he asked her. "I feel very well. I am weak, but I feel that I am cured." There was no longer any doubt. Marie's condition was improving so fast that she was scarcely recognizable. Standing beside the stretcher, profoundly troubled, unable to analyze what he beheld, Lorac looked at M. He stood there in silence, his mind a blank. This event, exactly the opposite of what he expected, was nothing more than a dream. Madame Doe offered Marie Ferrand a cup of milk. She drank it all. In a few minutes, she raised her head, looked around, moved her limbs a little, turned on her side without any sign of pain. Abruptly, he moved off. Making his way through the crowd of pilgrims whose loud prayers he could hardly hear, he left the grotto. It was 4 o'clock. A dying girl was recovering. It was the resurrection of the dead. It was a miracle. Had he not examined her, he would not know the real condition of her lesions, but he had seen with his own eyes a functional improvement that was itself a miracle. Later on, at 7 o'clock in the evening, he writes, "The abdomen wall is supple, elastic, without any depression, except a slight depression, which is normal. The aorta beats under the finger. The colon is investigated." Next morning at 6:30 a.m., her general condition is perfect. The patient gets up alone and has breakfast. Her respiration is normal, so is her heartbeat. Her abdomen is absolutely normal. The hard mass observed yesterday has gone completely. Now, Marie Ferrand walked, or Marie Bally, as her real name was, walked to the station at Lourdes. She took the train by herself and got off in Lyon and walked to her home, her astonished relatives, the next day meeting someone who had come back from the dead. And she was a sister of charity for 35 years. I challenge any honest person to read this account of Dr. Alexis Carrel, Nobel Prize winner, for many years president of the most prestigious scientific institution in the United States at that time, and still very, very prestigious, to tell me that there is no such thing as a miracle. You may want to say that the miracles of the gospel happened in some other way. You can say that if you wish. But a priori, just because somebody doesn't believe in miracles, to discount these accounts is dishonest. Pope John Paul II, in a series of talks that he gave on miracles called Wonders and Signs, said, "The only reason to deny the validity of the evangelical miracles, the miracles contained in the gospel, is a rationalist prejudice against the supernatural. I want to say very clearly that Jesus without miracles is a very shabby Messiah. If you're going to believe in Jesus, you should believe in him with all the mystery around him. Never mind those who would like to turn back the clock 2,000 years. I'm going to come back to their historical reconstructions in the next segment of this talk. But do know, miracles happen in the 20th century. They happen quite often. And to pretend that they didn't happen in the gospel is really to undermine the credibility of the Messiah. the fathers of the church, constantly alluded to the miracles of Christ as the proof of his divinity. And surely he would have been a very sad and unbelievable God if he was simply bound by the laws that rationalists would like to bind him by 2,000 years later. We will come back to the question, who is the real Jesus?